Welcome to the latest Oxford Institute for Energy Studies podcast. My name is David Ledesma and I'm Chairman of the Natural Gas Programme and Senior Fellow at the Institute. It's my great pleasure to be joined today by David Robinson, who's Senior Research Fellow at the Institute, to discuss his recent paper, Prices Behind the Meter, Efficient Economic Signals to Support Decarbonisation, that was recently published by the OAS. I'm recording this out of London while David is in Madrid. David, great to have you on board. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you, David. Great to be here.
We're recording this right at the beginning of April, so these are tough times, aren't they?
They are. I'm lucky to be in a house where I'm sort of out of town, but yes, it's very difficult time in Madrid.
Well, why don't we kind of start off by asking really a very simple question? Can you tell our listeners what do you mean by behind the meter?
What happens in the premises of the consumer? So in your house, in the building where you live, could even be in a larger complex. But basically, it's what happens on this side of the meter in your home. It includes the most basic things, such as, you know, using your electricity for light or for your refrigerator. But it's become much more interesting since consumers have been able to have some kind of control over the production of their electricity with solar panels or with batteries, electric vehicles. If you want smart thermostats. So the behind the meter concept has become relevant because it reflects the potential for consumers to have some control over their energy supply. And as I'll explain later, I think this changes everything in the electricity sector and in the energy sector.
So just tell us, how important are these behind the meter technologies in enabling the decarbonisation of the electrical sector, say in comparison to a centralised power generation technology from renewables or decarbonising gas?
Well, let me say first of all that both the decarbonised large scale energy sources and behind the meter facilities, which are usually smaller and owned by consumers, they're both important. The first thing to say there is that they both provide flexibility. And since we're in a system now with intermittent renewables, we need to have flexibility to back up those renewables when the sun's not shining or the wind is not blowing. So both of them do. The large-scale assets usually provide longer-term certainty when, say, the wind doesn't blow for a week or 2 weeks, whereas the demand flexibility and what happens behind the meter is usually much more valuable in short-term periods, say, during the day or over a couple of days.
Right.
The second thing to say is that what's happened here is not just about making the electricity system work better, but where consumer participation and behind the meter activity really matters is also outside the, if you want, thinking of it in terms of new uses of electricity, so electric vehicles or heat pumps, which will replace internal combustion engines or say gas heating. So what we have to think about in terms of behind the meter is changing the energy system, not just the electricity system. I think it's also important to think about how it changes the industry structure, because in the past, we had vertically integrated industry with generation far away, long-term, long-distance transport, local transport, and now what we have is a system where basically things are happening at a local level.
Yeah, it's a fundamental change, isn't it? But an important part of this, of course, is the role of government. And something you actually say in your paper, because you argue that electricity prices today in many European countries are much higher than the incremental cost of supplying energy due to something called government wedge. So could you tell us what government wedge is?
Yes. Well, first of all, just let me say that one of the reasons why prices are so important is because they send signals to consumers about what to invest in or how to consume. And therefore, it's really important that prices reflect costs.
Yeah.
In the case of the government wedge, what we're really talking about here are taxes and levies. Taxes, which you cover sort of general government expenditure, and levies, which are specifically for particular costs, such as supporting renewables. So what we found is over the last 10 years, the share of the electricity price from taxes and levies has increased significantly. In some countries, it can be as much as 50%. Say in Germany and Denmark, Spain. And as a result of this, we're getting price signals which don't reflect the costs.
Yeah. That's really interesting, because that must be having an impact on electricity consumers, isn't it? It must be changing consumers' patterns.
Yes, basically what it's doing is it's encouraging consumers to self-generate.
Yeah.
Now, this basically means that instead of buying from the system because it's expensive, especially when this extra wedge is included in the variable cost, mm-hmm. they can avoid paying that tax and generate if they generate themselves. It also has the effect of increasing the price of electricity and making it harder if you want to electrify, say, through electric vehicles or through heat pumps. It makes it more difficult because it becomes more expensive compared to, say, fossil fuels.
So broadly, you know, what can be done to address the kind of unintended consequences of the government wedge? Because surely electrical consumers just want to pay the lowest price.
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it's important to recognize the implications of them deciding, say, to produce their own electricity rather than buy from the system. Mm-hmm. This has sort of two effects. One is that it shifts taxes to other consumers, usually the poorer consumers, because it's the more wealthy ones who can afford to invest in electric vehicles and rooftop solar, and it may be the poorer pay more. So there's an equity question here. There's also an efficiency question, because what we're talking about now is more expensive electricity is replacing cheaper electricity. And I mean by that renewable electricity produced at scale is usually much cheaper than when it's produced on your rooftop. So we're effectively raising the cost of decarbonization. Yeah. You asked also about what we could do about that.
Yeah.
I mean, there really are sort of, I think it depends on the specific type of cost that we're talking about. You should always be including the environmental externalities in the tax. That is, the price should reflect the environmental externalities, say, from CO2. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to, say, public goods, such as renewable energy and supporting them, the academic sort of consensus is that those costs should be shared through the tax system and not levied on a specific technology.
So that
then leads to the question of, well, how do we get the government to accept to pay, or how are they going to recover those additional costs that are not being paid by the electricity consumer? That's when it gets complicated.
I was just going to say, I find that absolutely fascinating. And I just wanted to pick up my particular example, because I have solar panels at the back of my house. I have an electric car, but I don't have a tariff that encourages me to actually use all these kind of facilities in an optimal way. You know, is that the crux of the problem?
It is part of the problem. And I think that the fact that consumers, for instance, it's not only tariffs, as we'll explain, I was going to explain later, mm-hmm. but it's also technology. You know, when people are given a commercial package along with technology, which makes it easy for them to smart charge their car, then it's got to be easy.
Yeah.
If the tariffs are designed in a way that doesn't actually give you any benefit from charging when the system is uncongested or when the costs on the system are lower, then, you know, many of the benefits that are available don't come through.
It's interesting. I'd like to pick up something which I found particularly interesting in your paper, and that was your proposal on fiscal reform, and in particular, sharing the policy cost of decarbonisation with the oil and the gas sector, which would argue that the tax burden's already high. Can you perhaps tell us something about that debate and your proposal?
Yes. Well, first of all, the oil prices are taxes are very high in oil prices. And up until, fairly recently, it's been argued that oil prices were high enough to cover all of the externalities which they were responsible for. Mm-hmm. But there's now a kind of a pushback on that for a number of reasons. One is that the taxes that are currently levied on oil were originally introduced also to pay for roads.
Yes.
So the idea was that one must recognize that the roads are being paid for as well, and that the taxes are not just there to cover environmental externalities. The other argument is that there is that the oil industry and gas industry receive subsidies, mm-hmm. so they in some sense aren't paying their way in that respect. But the third one, which is interesting in the context of the European Union, is that there is an obligation on the member states to reach a certain level of renewable energy mm-hmm. Per as a percentage of consumption.
Yeah.
All the energies together are supposed to achieve that objective, but basically almost all of it happens through electricity. So the argument is, well, wait a minute, if this is supposed to be reducing emissions for the energy sector, yeah, we should share it among all.
Yeah.
So the recommendation, by the way, the recommendation, which was a directive that has not passed, but which is now back on the table, is to tax all energies in the same way on the basis of their emissions, mm-hmm, and their energy content. And that would indeed raise the taxes on oil and gas and lower them on electricity, but it would have some kind of a structure, yeah, which made sense.
Yeah, quite controversial, may I say. I'm a gas man, but we won't move to there. But I'd like to take the discussion that I can to the issue of networks, specifically electrical networks. You know, how does the kind of behind-the-meter technology challenge the way in which electricity networks are currently being remunerated for the delivery of electricity to consumers?
Well, first of all, the way they're being remunerated right now reflects the old role that networks played.
Right.
If you want, up until recently, networks took they were quite simple. They took electricity from large generators and they brought them to the consumers. We knew the direction. Mm-hmm. We knew more or less how to forecast demand. We knew how to get the money back without major difficulty. But when distributed energy, that is, say, renewable energy, was being built on the distribution network,
yeah,
and other types of changes were happening on the distribution network, say, from the consumer's side, fluctuations in generation as well as fluctuations in demand meant that there was much more uncertainty about what would be passing through the network and which direction it would be going.
Basically
we've got much more complexity on the system, which requires not only different kinds of systems and investments, but also incentives to use the system properly.
But that's interesting, because that's completely different, isn't it? So policymakers, therefore, their objectives, of course, are changing because of that. So what type of objectives do you think policymakers should be aiming at to achieve and designing a network charge?
Well, I think there's three that are now recognized as being important. One is always going to be remuneration, which recognizes now that the networks are smarter. They're not stupid in the way that they used to be before. They need digital sophistication in order to cope with these changes in their use.
Yeah.
The second one is they have to provide, that's in terms of total revenue being earned. But the second sort of objective is giving efficient signals,
yeah,
to consumers about the way they use the network so that they consume at times when the system is not congested,
yeah,
and they don't consume when it is congested.
Yeah.
And the third is, and this is a, if you want an add-on, which before didn't matter, is they should be consistent with decarbonization. And in particular, you'll see that there's an argument which says that certain sorts of tariffs favor electrification more than others do.
Yeah. I found it interesting, because we're speaking today when you're in Spain and Madrid, and I'm in the UK, and in your paper you discuss an innovative proposal, which was considered in Spain, on how electricity networks could charge for access when there's a lot of distribution behind the meter generation, which would encourage the efficient use of network by consumers and also, of course, cover the network costs. Perhaps you could summarize. It's a nice practical example to talk about. Perhaps you can give us some more details on that.
Yeah. Okay, well, that system is, it was a proposal made by one of the electricity companies in Spain, and their idea, which had also been made by a report from MIT on the future of utilities. And it was really to say, historically, we would think about charging consumers, since most costs are fixed on networks, the idea was, well, we'll charge consumers a fixed charge on the use of the network, and we'll get our money back. And in any case, there's no efficiency gains because there's no marginal costs. There's no efficiency gains by having a variable component. But the new idea is that because you actually care about congestion costs are important. Mm. And so you actually want to have prices which vary at different times of the year and the day. So this proposal has three different pricing periods. One is very, very uncongested, which is like a green light,
yep,
at the point the cost would be very low. The variable charge would be very low. And then there's the yellow light, which is there's some congestion maybe on the transmission network, slightly higher price to discourage use. And then there's a very few hours, maybe 10% at most of the year, when it's very congested. That's called the red light period. And those prices are very high. So the aim is to get people to move away from those high period, high congestion periods, and frankly, make those people who want to use it then pay for it.
Yeah, but that, of course, requires technology, doesn't it? You know, and in Spain, have you got a high rollout of smart meters, or is that still something that's happening?
Yes, I mean, we have virtually a full rollout of smart meters right now, which I should say that it's primarily used currently by the system itself, rather than by consumers. Consumers don't pay much attention yet to their smart meters, but this would be a way of measuring when they were consuming.
But of course, you know, it's a certain type of person who's going to actually invest in a smart meter. What about kind of the other end of the scale, you know, which are perhaps a kind of perhaps low income consumers? You know, how might changes in the network tariff impact them?
Well, that's important for a variety of reasons, but they too will have a smart meter because that's what the legislation requires. But and I think we need to distinguish here between what you might call the energy poor and you know and normal customers. I mean, the energy poor in all countries will have special arrangements. But there's a sort of a general presumption that if you have high fixed charges, this will hurt the poor because they will be consuming less. But now there's a question mark about that because some of the poorest have large families, poorly insulated housing, and so it may not be the case that this is true. And their wealthy people have ways of now producing their own electricity. The main message I want to take away from this sort of point is that there are you don't want to necessarily distort the tariff, but you can get rid of the government wedge on the tariff for the people who have less income.
Interesting. Well, look, what I'd like to do is I'd like to move on for the kind of last part of our podcast today to talk about another related issue on which you've been writing for on the with the Oxford Institute of Energy Studies, and that's of electricity markets. So I think the question I'd like to ask is, can the kind of behind-the-meter technologies we've been talking about participate in electricity markets, and at what scale?
Yeah. Well, first of all, historically, behind-the-meter for large industrial consumers was always an opportunity for them to sell their flexibility into markets. So they were interruptible markets or they sold into capacity markets, but that was the large customers. The small customers have really had very little opportunity to sell into markets. More recently, they've been given feed-in tariffs for their excess generation and in some countries paid on the basis of the market price for their exports. But what is really changing everything is in terms of scale and in terms of cost of behind the meter opportunities is the development of new technologies and new market players, particularly aggregators, that by aggregating a number, hundreds or thousands of these behind the meter activities, they can provide what amounts to virtual power plants. So they can actually compete with generators in the system.
Yeah. I think because, of course, as we did talk about earlier on about in regulation, it is European regulation that's going to actually drive the kind of behind-the-meter technologies. So I think I've got a double question here is, you know, are the current European regulations conducive to that? And also, do you think there are any changes in the market rules that need to take place to kind of drive this role? What do you think?
Yeah, well, first of all, I think it's fair to say that the market design does not support yet, the active participation of consumers. To begin with, the markets were designed for the 20th century technology and economics, which were large-scale power stations far away from consumers, and with consumers playing virtually no role. And these power stations were, you know, fossil-fired power stations with certain sort of economics with high variable costs, which they used to, which were the basis for setting market prices. What we now have is technology which is distributed, which is renewable, and where markets were really not designed for those sorts of technologies or for that economic for those economics. So passing on to your second part, what you know, what can one do about it? I mean, there's sort of three big buckets that one can sort of describe. One has to do with enabling consumers and through aggregators in particular to get into all the existing markets so that they aren't excluded either because of size or technology from playing in those markets. Mm-hmm. The second is creating new markets, which previously weren't needed but now are.
Right.
And the third is actually rethinking the entire market design,
yeah,
and so starting from scratch. Those are the three big buckets, and happy to talk about each if we have time.
No, I thought you don't, but I would like to perhaps pick up locally on Spain, actually, because, you know, that's an area you've been really focusing on. You know, can you summarize perhaps what they've done to manage local congestion market? And also, you know, is it very complicated? Because it sounds to me like it's quite a complicated proposal here, David.
Yeah, well, their idea is to, first of all, their idea is that the big problem today is on the distribution network because of all the new distributed energy resources, which are making it more complex and congestion more unpredictable. And so their idea is we need a market in order to manage that uncertainty and to basically to get the lowest possible cost of reducing the congestion.
Yeah.
So they have a little bit like on the tariff design. There's sort of three traffic light conditions. When there's green traffic light, it means there's no congestion. We don't need a market. Consumers can sell their electricity through the system into the wholesale market.
Right, got it.
However, if there's yellow conditions, they'll call that sort of a temporary congestion problem. Next Tuesday at 12, mm-hmm, then we'll have an auction, and the behind the meter suppliers can actually compete in that auction and win it, mm-hmm, okay, providing flexibility. And then there's the red conditions when we actually need new investment, mm-hmm, in which case there's another type of auction, and the behind the meter options can bid into that auction as well. So again, that's the specific. Yes, it is complex, and it's not yet been introduced. It's just still being discussed. So I wouldn't pretend that they've solved the problem.
Well, I think, David, you know, I think it's going to happen. Let's be clear about that. You know, it's going to happen. I think and what seems complex today will actually become the norm and the norm in the future. But unfortunately, you know, we're coming to the end of our time. But, you know, I've really enjoyed our discussion. But over the last 20 minutes, we've discussed an awful lot of issues. And I'd like to really end, you know, by the last couple of minutes, by returning to the big issue, if I may. It seems that policymakers have choices in decarbonising the electrical system, and they lie in kind of two extremes: more use of markets or more government intervention. And I just wondered, you know, that's what I've concluded. Do you agree with that?
Yes and no. Yes, yes, because we really do now face that question. Do we or do we not maintain what is currently a very, very heavy role for government in deciding virtually what gets built, what the prices are, or do we allow markets to play a greater role? I think up until, say, over the last 10 years, because of the decarbonization objective, governments have had a reason to intervene in order to fix market failures. But now that we are in a situation where these technologies are becoming competitive, one has to ask whether there's not time now to allow markets again to work. The reason I say no, in other words, I think both are important.
Right, right.
But I think that markets will become more important than they have been over the last 10 years. Now, but there's a separate question, which I think is even more important, which is what role consumers play in this.
Yeah,
because
yeah,
markets up to now have been big players, and they've been able to, from very much a supply side business. Now we're talking about the potential for consumers to choose the mix of energy that they wish to purchase, to decide what kind of supply security they want to buy from the system, and to do a lot themselves. And with that, I think it changes everything.
And just one last, we're sitting here, as I said, on the 3rd of April or 2nd of April, you know, COVID-19, the terrible crisis, you know. Briefly, you know, what do you think the implications are for the role of consumers? Because you mentioned they're so important in this.
You know, I think that there's going to be a significant pressure it's going to be a positive impact for two reasons. One is I think that it's going to create a greater degree of cohesion in local communities, which will give them reasons to want to be working together on local energy solutions. And I think governments are going to see it as positive that they can actually stimulate the economy by encouraging construction in the local area and the development of local energy communities.
Well, David, you know, I can't thank you enough for your time today, because I've really enjoyed our discussion. I'm not just the expert, But I, you know, you very clearly and simply set out the challenges facing us, you know. And so, you know, it really builds upon your paper that I urge our listeners to read, Prices Behind the Meter, Efficient Economic Signals to Support Decarbonisation, that, as with all our papers, can be found at the Oxford Institute for Energy Studies website, www.oxfordenergy.org, where you can find not only our papers in the multimedia folder, but the other papers published by the Institute. I really hope you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, and thank you and goodbye to everyone.